Chapter 4. Fortunately for Backman, though he had no way of knowing and no reason to care, at the 11th hour, President Morgan also pardoned an aging billionaire who had escaped prison by fleeing the country. The billionaire, an immigrant from some Slavic state who had had the option of redoing his name upon his arrival decades earlier, had chosen in his youth the title of Duke Mongo. The Duke had given trainloads of money to Morgan's presidential campaign. When it was revealed that he had spent his career evading taxes, it was also revealed he had spent several nights in the Lincoln bedroom, where over a friendly nightcap, he and the president discussed pending indictments. According to the third person present for the nightcap, a young tart who was currently serving as the Duke's fifth wife, the president promised to throw his weight around over at the IRS and call off the dogs. Didn't happen. The indictment was 38 pages long, and before it rolled off the printer, the billionaire, minus wife number 5, took up residence in Uruguay, where he thumbed his nose north while living in a palace with soon-to-be wife number 6. Now he wanted to come home so he could die with dignity, die as a real patriot, and be buried on his thoroughbred farm just outside Lexington, Kentucky. Kritz cut the deal, and minutes after signing the pardon for Joel Backman, President Morgan granted complete clemency to Duke Mongo. It took a day for the news to leak. The pardons, for good reason, were not publicized by the White House, and the press went insane. Here was a man who cheated the federal government out of $600 million over a 20-year period, a crook who deserved to be locked away forever, and he was about to fly home in his mammoth jet and spend his final days in obscene luxury. The Backman story, sensational as it was, now had serious competition from not only the kidnapped Danish tourists, but also the country's largest tax cheater. But it was still a hot item. Most of the major morning papers along the East Coast ran a picture of the broker somewhere on the front page. Most ran long stories about his scandal, his guilty plea, and now his pardon. Carl Pratt read them all online in a huge, messy office he kept above his garage in Northwest Washington. He used the place to hide, to stay away from the wars that raged within his firm, to avoid the partners he couldn't stand. He could drink there, and no one would care. He could throw things and curse at the walls and do whatever he damn well pleased because it was his sanctuary. The Backman file was in a large cardboard storage box, one he kept hidden in a closet. Now it was on a work table, and Pratt was going through it for the first time in many years. He had saved everything. News articles, photos, interoffice memos, sensitive notes he'd taken, copies of the indictments, J.C. Hubbard's autopsy report. What a miserable history. In January of 1996, three young Pakistani computer scientists made an astounding discovery. Working in a hot, cramped flat on the top floor of an apartment building on the outskirts of Karachi, the three linked together a series of Hewlett-Packard computers they had purchased online with a government grant. Their new supercomputer was then wired to a sophisticated military satellite telephone, one also provided by the government. The entire operation was secret and funded off the books by the military. Their objective was simple: to locate and then try to access a new Indian spy satellite hovering 300 miles above Pakistan. If they successfully tapped into the satellite, then they hoped to monitor its surveillance. A secondary dream was to try to manipulate it. The stolen intelligence was at first exciting, then proved to be virtually useless. The new Indian eyes were doing much the same thing the old ones had been doing for 10 years, taking thousands of photographs of the same military installations. Pakistani satellites had been sending back photos of Indian army bases and troop movements for the same 10 years. The two countries could swap pictures and learn nothing. But another satellite was accidentally discovered, then another and another. They were neither Pakistani nor Indian, and they were not supposed to be where they were found. each about 300 miles above the Earth, moving north-northeast at a constant speed of 120 miles per hour, and each maintaining a distance of 400 miles from the other. Over 10 days, the terribly excited hackers monitored the movements of at least 6 different satellites, all apparently part of the same system, as they slowly approached from the Arabian Peninsula, swept through the skies over Afghanistan and Pakistan, then headed off for western China. They told no one, but instead managed to procure a more powerful satellite telephone from the military, claiming it was needed to follow up some unfinished work with the Indian surveillance. After a month of methodical 24-hour monitoring, they had pieced together a global web of 9 identical satellites, all linked to each other and all carefully designed to be invisible to everyone except the men who launched them. They codenamed their discovery Neptune. The 3 young wizards had been educated in the United States. Their leader was Safi Mirza, a former Stanford graduate assistant who had worked briefly at Breeden Corp., a renegade U.S. defense contractor that specialized in satellite systems. Fazl Sharif had an advanced degree in computer science from Georgia Tech. The 3rd and youngest member of the Neptune gang was Farouk Khan, and it was Farouk who finally wrote the software that penetrated the first Neptune satellite. Once inside its computer system, Farouk began downloading intelligence so sensitive that he and Fazl and Safi knew they were entering no man's land. There were clear color pictures of terrorist training camps in Afghanistan and government limousines in Beijing. Neptune could listen as Chinese pilots bantered back and forth at 20,000 feet, and it could watch a suspicious fishing boat as it docked in Yemen. Neptune followed an armored truck, presumably Castro's, through the streets of Havana. And in a live video feed that shocked the 3, Arafat himself was clearly seen stepping into an alley in his compound in Gaza, lighting a cigarette, then urinating. For 2 sleepless days, the 3 peeked inside the satellites as they crossed Pakistan. The software was in English, and with Neptune's preoccupation with the Middle East, Asia, and China, it was easy to assume Neptune belonged to the United States, with Britain and Israel a distant 2nd and 3rd. Perhaps it was a joint U.S.-Israeli secret. After 2 days of eavesdropping, they fled the apartment and reorganized their little cell in a friend's farmhouse 10 miles outside of Karachi. The discovery was exciting enough, but they, and Safi in particular, wanted to go one step further. He was quite confident he could manipulate the system. His first success was watching Fazl Sharif read a newspaper. To protect the identity of their location, Fazl took a bus into downtown Karachi, and wearing a green cap and sunglasses, he bought a newspaper and sat on a park bench near a certain intersection. With Farouk feeding commands through a ramped-up sat phone, a Neptune satellite found Fazl, zoomed down close enough to pick off the headlines of his newspaper, and relayed it all back to the farmhouse, where it was watched in muted disbelief. The electro-optical imaging relays to Earth were of the highest resolution known to technology at that time, down to about 4 feet, equal to the sharpest images produced by U.S. military reconnaissance satellites and about twice as sharp as the best European and American commercial satellites. For weeks and months, the 3 worked nonstop writing home-brewed software for their discovery. They discarded much of what they wrote, but as they fine-tuned the successful programs, they became even more amazed at Neptune's possibilities. 18 months after they first discovered Neptune, the 3 had, on 4 Jazz 2-gigabyte disks, a software program that not only increased the speed at which Neptune communicated with its numerous contacts on Earth, but also allowed Neptune to jam many of the navigation, communications, and reconnaissance satellites already in orbit. For lack of a better code name, they called their program JAM. Though the system they called Neptune belonged to someone else, the 3 conspirators were able to control it, to thoroughly manipulate it, and even to render it useless. A bitter fight erupted. Safi and Fazl got greedy and wanted to sell jam to the highest bidder. Farouk saw nothing but trouble with their creation. He wanted to give it to the Pakistani military and wash his hands of the entire matter. In September of 1998, Safi and Fazl traveled to Washington and spent a frustrating month trying to penetrate military intelligence through Pakistani contacts. Then a friend told them about Joel Backman, the man who could open any door in Washington. But getting in his door was a challenge. The broker was a very important man with important clients and lots of significant people demanding small segments of his time. His flat fee for a one-hour consultation with a new client was $5,000, and that was for those lucky enough to be looked upon with favor by the great man. Safi borrowed $2,000 from an uncle in Chicago and promised to pay Mr. Backman the rest in 90 days. Documents in court later revealed that their first meeting took place on October 24, 1998, in the offices of Backman, Pratt, and Bowling. The meeting would eventually destroy the lives of everyone present. Backman at first had seemed skeptical of JAM and its incredible capabilities. Or perhaps he had grasped its potential immediately and chosen to play it sly with his new clients. Safi and Fazl dreamed of selling JAM to the Pentagon for a fortune, whatever Mr. Backman thought their product might fetch. And if anyone in Washington could get a fortune for JAM, it was Joel Backman. Early on, he had called in J.C. Hubbard, his million-dollar mouthpiece, who still played golf once a week with the president and went bar-hopping with big shots on Capitol Hill. He was colorful, flamboyant, combative, thrice divorced, and quite fond of expensive whiskeys, especially when purchased by lobbyists. He had survived politically only because he was known as the dirtiest campaigner in the history of the U.S. Senate. No small feat. He was known to be anti-Semitic, and during the course of his career, he developed close ties with the Saudis. Very close. One of many ethics investigations revealed a $1 million campaign contribution from a prince, the same one Hubbard went skiing with in Austria. Initially, Hubbard and Backman argued over the best way to market JAM. Hubbard wanted to peddle it to the Saudis, who he was convinced would pay $1 billion for it. Backman had taken the rather provincial view that such a dangerous product should be kept at home. Hubbard was convinced he could cut a deal with the Saudis in which they would promise that JAM would never be used against the United States, their ostensible ally. Backman was afraid of the Israelis, their powerful friends in the United States, their military, and most important, their secret spy services. At that time, Backman, Pratt, and Bowling represented many foreign companies and governments. In fact, the firm was the address for anyone looking for instant clout in Washington. Pay their frightening fees, and you had yourself access. Its endless list of clients included the Japanese steel industry, the South Korean government, the Saudis, most of the Caribbean banking conspiracy, the current regime in Panama, a Bolivian farming cooperative that grew nothing but cocaine, and on and on. There were many legitimate clients and many that were not so clean. The rumor about JAM slowly leaked around their offices. It could potentially be the largest fee the firm had yet seen, and there had been some startling ones. As weeks passed, other partners in the firm presented varying scenarios for the marketing of JAM. The notion of patriotism was slowly forgotten. There was simply too much money out there. The firm represented a Dutch company that built avionics for the Chinese Air Force, and with that entree, a lucrative deal could be struck with the Beijing government. The South Koreans would rest easier if they knew exactly what was happening to the North. The Syrians would hand over their national treasury for the ability to neutralize Israeli military communications. A certain drug cartel would pay billions for the ability to track DEA interdiction efforts. Each day, Joel Backman and his band of greedy lawyers grew richer. In the firm's largest offices, They talked of little else. The doctor was rather brusque and appeared to have little time for his new patient. It was, after all, a military hospital. With scarcely a word, he checked the pulse, heart, lungs, blood pressure, reflexes, and so on, then from out of the blue announced,
"I think you're dehydrated."
"How's that?" Backman asked.
"Happens a lot with long flights. We'll start a drip. You'll be okay in 24 hours.
"You mean like an IV?"
"That's it."
"I don't do IVs."
"Beg your pardon?"
"I didn't stutter. I don't do needles."
"We took a sample of your blood."
"Yeah, that was blood going out, not something coming in. Forget it, Doc. I'm not doing an IV."
"But you're dehydrated."
"I don't feel dehydrated."
"I'm the doctor, and I say you're dehydrated."
"Then give me a glass of water." Half an hour later, a nurse entered with a big smile and a handful of medications. Joel said no to the sleeping pills, and when she sort of waved a hypodermic, he said,
"What's that?"
"Ryax."
"What the hell is Ryax?"
"It's a muscle relaxer."
"Well, it just so happens that my muscles are very relaxed right now. I haven't complained of unrelaxed muscles. I haven't been diagnosed with unrelaxed muscles. No one has asked me if my muscles are relaxed. So you can take that Ryax and stick it up your own ass, and we'll both be relaxed and happier."
She almost dropped the needle. After a long, painful pause in which she was completely speechless, she managed to utter,
"I'll check with the doctor."
"You do that. On second thought, why don't you poke him in his rather fat ass? He's the one who needs to relax." But she was already out of the room. On the other side of the base, a Sergeant McAuliffe pecked on his keyboard and sent a message to the Pentagon. From there, it was sent almost immediately to Langley, where it was read by Julia Javier, a veteran who had been selected by Director Maynard himself to handle the Backman matter. Less than 10 minutes after the Ryax incident, Ms. Javier stared at her monitor, mumbled the word, "Damn it," then walked upstairs. As usual, Teddy Maynard was sitting at the end of a long table, wrapped in a quilt, reading one of the countless summaries that got piled on his desk every hour. Ms. Javier said,
"Just heard from Aviano. Our boy is refusing all medications. Won't take an IV, won't take a pill."
"Can't they put something in his food?"
Teddy said at low volume.
"He's not eating."
"What's he saying?"
"That his stomach is upset."
"Is that possible?"
"He's not spending time on the toilet, hard to say."
"Is he taking liquids?"
"They took him a glass of water, which he refused, insisted on bottled water only. When he got one, he inspected the cap to make sure the seal had not been broken."
Teddy shoved the current report away and rubbed his eyes with his knuckles. The first plan had been to sedate Backman in the hospital with either an IV or a regular injection, knock him out cold, keep him drugged for 2 days, then slowly bring him back with some delightful blends of their most up-to-date narcotics. After a few days in a haze, they would start the sodium pentothal treatment, the truth serum, which, when used with their veteran interrogators, always produced whatever they were after. The first plan was easy and foolproof. The second one would take months, and success was far from guaranteed.
"He's got big secrets, doesn't he?"
Teddy said.
"No doubt."
"But we knew that, didn't we?"
"Yes, we did."
Chapter 5. Two of Joel Backman's 3 children had already abandoned him when the scandal broke. The oldest, Neil, had written his father at least 2x a month, though in the early days of the sentence, the letters had been quite difficult to write. Neil had been a 25-year-old rookie associate at the Backman firm when his father went to prison. Though he knew little about Jam and Neptune, he was nonetheless harassed by the FBI and eventually indicted by federal prosecutors. Joel's abrupt decision to plead guilty was aided mightily by what happened to J.C. Hubbard, but it was also pushed along by the mistreatment of his son by the authorities. All charges against Neil were dropped in the deal. When his father left for 20 years,
Neil was immediately terminated by Carl Pratt and escorted from the firm's offices by armed security. The Backman name was a curse, and employment was impossible around Washington. A pal from law school had an uncle who was a retired judge, and after calls here and there, Neil landed in the small town of Culpeper, Virginia, working in a five-man firm and thankful for the opportunity. He craved the anonymity. He thought about changing his name. He refused to discuss his father. He did title work, wrote wills and deeds, and settled nicely into the routine of small-town living. He eventually met and married a local girl, and they quickly produced a daughter, Joel's second grandchild, and the only one he had a photo of. Neil read about his father's release in the Post. He discussed it at length with his wife, and briefly with the partners of his firm. The story might be causing earthquakes in D.C., but the tremors had not reached Culpeper. No one seemed to know or care. He wasn't the broker's son. He was simply Neil Backman, one of many lawyers in a small southern town. A judge pulled him aside after a hearing and said, "Where are they hiding your old man?" To which Neil replied respectfully, "Not one of my favorite subjects, Your Honor." And that was the end of the conversation. On the surface, nothing changed in Culpeper. Neil went about his business as if the pardon had been granted to a man he didn't know. He waited on a phone call. Somewhere down the road, his father would eventually check in. After repeated demands, the supervising nurse passed the hat and collected almost $3 in change. This was delivered to the patient they still called Major Herzog, an increasingly cranky sort whose condition was no doubt worsening because of hunger. Major Herzog took the money and proceeded directly to the vending machines he had found on the second floor, and there he bought 3 small bags of Fritos corn chips and 2 Dr. Peppers. All were consumed within minutes, and an hour later he was on the toilet with raging diarrhea. But at least he wasn't quite as hungry, nor was he drugged and saying things he shouldn't say. Though technically a free man, fully pardoned and all that, he was still confined to a facility owned by the U.S. government and still living in a room not much larger than his cell at Rudley. The food there had been dreadful, but at least he could eat it without fear of being sedated. Now he was living on corn chips and sodas. The nurses were only slightly friendlier than the guards who tormented him. The doctors just wanted to dope him, following orders from above, he was certain. Somewhere close by was a little torture chamber where they were waiting to pounce on him after the drugs had worked their miracles. He longed for the outside, for fresh air and sunshine, for plenty of food, for a little human contact with someone not wearing a uniform. And after 2 very long days, he got it. A stone-faced young man named Stennett appeared in his room on the 3rd day and began pleasantly by saying, "Okay, Backman, here's the deal. My name's Stennett." He tossed a file on the blankets on Joel's legs next to some old magazines that were being read for the 3rd time. Joel opened the file. "Marco Lazzari?" "That's you, pal. A full-blown Italian now. That's your birth certificate and national ID card. Memorize all the info as soon as possible."
"Memorize it? I can't even read it."
"Then learn. We're leaving in about 3 hours. You'll be taken to a nearby city where you'll meet your new best friend, who'll hold your hand for a few days."
"A few days?"
"Maybe a month. Depends on how well you make the transition."
Joel laid down the file and stared at Stennett. "Who do you work for?"
"If I told you, then I'd have to kill you."
"Very funny. The CIA?
"The USA. That's all I can say. And that's all you need to know."
Joel looked at the metal-framed window, complete with a lock, and said, "I didn't notice a passport in the file."
"Yes, well, that's because you're not going anywhere, Marco. You're about to live a very quiet life. Your neighbors will think you were born in Milan but raised in Canada. Thus the bad Italian you're about to learn.
If you get the urge to travel, then things could get very dangerous for you.
Dangerous?
Come on, Marco, don't play games with me. There are some really nasty people in this world who'd love to find you. Do what we tell you, and they won't.
I don't know a word of Italian.
Sure you do. Pizza, spaghetti, caffè latte, bravo, opera, mamma mia. You'll catch on. The quicker you learn, and the better you learn, the safer you'll be. You'll have a tutor.
I don't have a dime.
That's what they say. None that they could find, anyway.
He pulled some bills out of his pocket and laid them on the file.
While you were tucked away, Italy abandoned the lira and adopted the euro. There's 100 of them. 1 euro is about a dollar. I'll be back in an hour with some clothes. In the file is a small dictionary, 200 of your first words in Italian. I suggest you get busy.
An hour later, Stennett was back with a shirt, slacks, jacket, shoes and socks, all of the Italian variety.
Buongiorno, he said.
Hello to you, Backman said.
What's a word for car?
Macchina.
Good, Marco. It's time to get in the macchina.
Another silent gentleman was behind the wheel of the compact, nondescript Fiat. Joel folded himself into the back seat with a canvas bag that held his net worth. Stennett sat in the front. The air was cold and damp, and a thin layer of snow barely covered the ground. When they passed through the gates of the Aviano airbase, Joel Backman had the first twinge of freedom, though the slight wave of excitement was heavily layered with apprehension. He watched the road signs carefully, not a word from the front seat. They were on Route 251, a two-lane highway headed south, he thought. The traffic soon grew heavy as they approached the city of Pordenone. What's the population of Pordenone? Joel asked, breaking the thick silence.
50,000, Stennett said.
This is northern Italy, right?
Northeast.
How far away are the Alps? Stennett nodded in the general direction of his right and said,
About 40 miles that way. On a clear day, you can see them.
Can we stop for a coffee somewhere? Joel asked.
No, we are not authorized to stop.
So far, the driver appeared to be completely deaf. They skirted around the northern edge of Pordenone and were soon on A28, a four-lane where everyone but the truckers appeared to be very late for work. Small cars whizzed by them while they puttered along at a mere 100 kilometers per hour. Stennett unfolded an Italian newspaper, La Repubblica, and blocked half the windshield with it. Joel was very content to ride in silence and gaze at the countryside flying by. The rolling plain appeared to be very fertile, though it was late January and the fields were empty. Occasionally, above a terraced hillside, an ancient villa could be seen. He had actually rented one once. A dozen or so years earlier, wife number two had threatened to walk out if he didn't take her somewhere for a long vacation. Joel was working 80 hours a week with time to spare for even more work. He preferred to live at the office, and judging by the way things were going at home, life would have certainly been more peaceful there. A divorce, however, would have cost too much money, so Joel announced to everyone that he and his dear wife would spend a month in Tuscany. He acted as though it had all been his idea, a month-long wine and culinary adventure through the heart of Chianti. They found a 14th-century monastery near the medieval village of San Gimignano, complete with housekeepers and cooks, even a chauffeur. But on the fourth day of the adventure, Joel received the alarming news that the Senate Appropriations Committee was considering deleting a provision that would wipe out $2 billion for one of his defense contractor clients. He flew home on a charter jet and went to work whipping the Senate back into shape. Wife number two stayed behind, where, as he would later learn, she began sleeping with the young chauffeur. For the next week, he called daily and promised to return to the villa to finish their vacation. But after the second week, she stopped taking his calls. The appropriations bill was put back together in fine fashion. A month later, she filed for divorce, a raucous contest that would eventually cost him over $3 million. And she was his favorite of the three.
They were all gone now, all scattered forever. The first, the mother of two of his children, had remarried twice since Joel, and her current husband had gotten rich selling liquid fertilizer in third world countries. She had actually written him in prison, a cruel little note in which she praised the judicial system for finally dealing with one of its biggest crooks. He couldn't blame her. She packed up after catching him with a secretary, the bimbo that became wife number two. Wife number three had jumped ship soon after his indictment. What a sloppy life. 52 years and what's to show for a career of bilking clients, chasing secretaries around the office, putting the squeeze on slimy little politicians, working 7 days a week, ignoring three surprisingly stable children, crafting the public image, building the boundless ego, pursuing money, money, money. What are the rewards for the reckless pursuit of the great American dream? 6 years in prison, and now a fake name because the old one is so dangerous, and about $100 in his pocket. Marco? How could he look himself in the mirror every morning and say, "Buongiorno, Marco"? Sure beat the hell out of "Good morning, Mr. Felon." Stennett didn't as much read the newspaper as he wrestled with it. Under his perusal, it jerked and popped and wrinkled, and at times the driver glanced over in frustration. A sign said Venice was 60 kilometers to the south, and Joel decided to break the monotony. "I'd like to live in Venice if that's all right with the White House." The driver flinched, and Stennett's newspaper dropped 6 inches. The air in the small car was tense for a moment, until Stennett managed a grunt and a shrug. "Sorry," he said. "I really need to pee," Joel said. "Can you get authorization to stop for a potty break?" They stopped north of the town of Conegliano at a modern roadside servizio. Stennett bought a round of corporate espressos. Joel took his to the front window where he watched the traffic speed by while he listened to a young couple snipe at each other in Italian. He heard none of the 200 words he had tried to memorize. It seemed an impossible task. Stennett appeared by his side and watched the traffic.
"Have you spent much time in Italy?" he asked.
"A month once in Tuscany."
"Really? A whole month? Must have been nice."
4 days, actually, but my wife stayed for a month. She met some friends. How about you? Is this one of your hangouts?"
"I move around."
His face was as vague as his answer. He sipped from the tiny cup and said, "Conegliano, known for its Prosecco." The Italian answer to champagne, Joel said.
"Yes. You're a drinking man?"
"Haven't touched a drop in 6 years."
"They didn't serve it in prison?"
"Nope."
"And now?"
"I'll ease back into it. It was a bad habit once."
"We'd better go."
"How much longer?"
"Not far."
Stennett headed for the door, but Joel stopped him. "Hey, look, I'm really hungry. Could I get a sandwich for the road?" Stennett looked at a rack of ready-made panini.
"Sure."
"How about two?"
"No problem."
827 led south to Treviso, and when it became apparent they would not bypass the city, Joel began to assume the ride was about to end. The driver slowed, made two exits, and they were soon bouncing through the narrow streets of the city. "What's the population of Treviso?" Joel asked.
85,000, Stennett answered.
"What do you know about the city?"
"It's a prosperous little city that hasn't changed much in 500 years. It was once a staunch ally of Venice back when these towns all fought with each other. We bombed the hell out of it in World War II. A nice place. Not too many tourists."
A good place to hide, Joel thought. Is this my stop?
Could be.
A tall clock tower beckoned all the traffic into the center of the city, where it inched along around the Piazza dei Signori. Scooters and mopeds zipped between cars, their drivers seemingly fearless. Joel soaked in the quaint little shops, the tabaccaria with racks of newspapers blocking the door, the farmacia with its neon green cross, the butcher with all manner of hams hanging in the window, and of course the tiny sidewalk cafes, where all tables were taken with people who appeared content to sit and read and gossip and sip espresso for hours. It was almost 11 a.m. What could those people possibly do for a living if they broke for coffee an hour before lunch? It would be his challenge to find out, he decided. The nameless driver wheeled into a temporary parking place. Stennett pecked numbers on a cell phone, waited, then spoke quickly in Italian. When he was finished, he pointed through the windshield and said, "You see that cafe over there, under the red and white awning? Cafe Donati?" Joel strained from the back seat and said, "Yeah, I got it." "Walk in the front door, past the bar on your right, onto the back, where there are 8 tables. Have a seat, order a coffee, and wait." "Wait for what?" "A man will approach you after about 10 minutes. You will do what he says." "And if I don't?" "Don't play games, Mr. Backman. We'll be watching." "Who is this man?" "Your new best friend. Follow him and you'll probably survive. Try something stupid and you won't last a month." Stennett said this with a certain smugness, as if he might enjoy being the one who rubbed out poor Marco. "So it's adios for us, huh?" Joel said, gathering his bag.
"Arrivederci, Marco." "Not adios."
"You have your paperwork?"
"Yes." "Then arrivederci."
Joel slowly got out of the car and began walking away. He fought the urge to glance over his shoulder to make sure Stennett, his protector, was paying attention and still back there, shielding him from the unknown. But he did not turn around. Instead, he tried to look as normal as possible as he strolled down the street carrying a canvas bag, the only canvas bag he saw at that moment in the center of Treviso. Stennett was watching, of course. And who else? Certainly his new best friend was over there somewhere, partially hiding behind a newspaper, giving signals to Stennett and the rest of the static. Joel stopped for a second in front of the tabaccheria and scanned the headlines of the Italian newspapers, though he understood not a single word. He stopped because he could stop, because he was a free man with the power and the right to stop wherever he wanted and to start moving whenever he chose to. He entered Café Donati and was greeted with a soft "buongiorno" from the young man wiping off the bar. "Buongiorno," Joel managed in reply, his first real words to a real Italian. To prevent further conversation, he kept walking past the bar, past a circular stairway where a sign pointed to a cafe upstairs, past a large counter filled with beautiful pastries. The back room was dark and cramped and choking under a fog of cigarette smoke. He sat down at one of 2 empty tables and ignored the glances of the other patrons. He was terrified of the waiter, terrified of trying to order, terrified of being unmasked so early in his flight. And so he just sat with his head down and read his new identity papers. "Buongiorno," the young lady said at his left shoulder. "Buongiorno," Joel managed to reply. And before she could rattle off anything on the menu, he said, "Espresso." She smiled, said something thoroughly incomprehensible, to which he replied, "No." It worked. She left. And for Joel, it was a major victory. No one stared at him as if he was some ignorant foreigner. When she brought the espresso, he said, "Grazie," very softly, and she actually smiled at him. He sipped it slowly, not knowing how long it would have to last, not wanting to finish it so he might be forced to order something else. Italian whirled around him, the soft, incessant chatter of friends, gossiping at a rapid-fire pace. Did English sound this fast? Probably so. The idea of learning the language well enough to be able to understand what was being said around him seemed thoroughly impossible. He looked at his paltry little list of 200 words, then for a few minutes tried desperately to hear a single one of them spoken. The waitress happened by and asked a question. He gave his standard reply of no, and again it worked. So Joel Backman was having an espresso in a small bar on Via Verde at the Piazza dei Signori in the center of Treviso in the Veneto in northeast Italy, while back at Rudley Federal Correctional Facility, his old pals were still locked down in protective isolation with lousy food and watery coffee and sadistic guards and silly rules and years to go before they could even dream of life on the outside. Contrary to previous plans, Joel Backman would not die behind bars at Rudley. He would not wither away in mind and body and spirit. He had cheated his tormentors out of 14 years, and now he sat, unshackled, in a quaint cafe an hour from Venice. Why was he thinking of prison? Because you can't just walk away from 6 years of anything without the aftershocks. You carry some of the past with you, regardless of how unpleasant it was. The horror of prison made his sudden release so sweet. It would take time, and he promised himself to focus on the present. Don't even think about the future. Listen to the sounds, the rapid chatter of friends, the laughter, the guy over there whispering into a cell phone, the pretty waitress calling into the kitchen. Take in the smells, the cigarette smoke, the rich coffee, the fresh pastries, the warmth of an ancient little room where locals had been meeting for centuries. And he asked himself for the 100th time, why exactly was he here? Why had he been whisked away from prison, then out of the country? A pardon is one thing, but why a full-blown international getaway? Why not hand him his walking papers, let him say so long to dear old Rudley and live his life same as all the other freshly pardoned criminals? He had a hunch. He could venture a fairly accurate guess. And it terrified him. Luigi appeared from nowhere. Chapter 6. Luigi was in his early 30s with dark, sad eyes and dark hair half covering his ears, and at least 4 days' worth of stubble on his face. He was bundled in some type of heavy barn jacket that, along with the unshaven face, gave him a handsome peasant look. He ordered an espresso and smiled a lot. Joel immediately noticed that his hands and nails were clean, his teeth were straight. The barn jacket and whiskers were part of the act. Luigi had probably gone to Harvard. His perfect English was accented just enough to convince anyone that he was really an Italian. He said he was from Milan. His Italian father was a diplomat who took his American wife and their 2 children around the world in service to his country. Joel was assuming Luigi knew plenty about him, so he prodded to learn what he could about his new handler. He didn't learn much. Marriage? None. College? Bologna. Studies in the United States? Yes, somewhere in the Midwest. Job? Government. Which government? Couldn't say. He had an easy smile that he used to deflect questions he didn't want to answer. Joel was dealing with a professional, and he knew it. I take it you know a thing or two about me, Joel said. The smile, the perfect teeth, the sad eyes almost closed when he smiled. The ladies were all over this guy. I've seen the file. The file? The file on me wouldn't fit in this room. I've seen the file. Okay, how long did J.C. Hubbard serve in the U.S. Senate?
Too long, I'd say. Look, Marco, we're not going to relive the past. We have too much to do now.
Can I have another name? I'm not crazy about Marco. It wasn't my choice.
Well, who picked Marco?
I don't know. It wasn't me. You ask a lot of useless questions. I was a lawyer for 25 years. It's an old habit. Luigi drained what was left of his espresso and placed some euros on the table. Let's go for a walk, he said, standing. Joel lifted his canvas bag and followed his handler out of the cafe onto the sidewalk and down a side street with less traffic. They had walked only a few steps when Luigi stopped in front of the Albergo Campeol. This is your first stop, he said. What is it? Joel asked.
It was a 4-story stucco building wedged between 2 others. Colorful flags hung above the portico.
A nice little hotel. Albergo means hotel. You can also use the word hotel if you want, but in the smaller cities they like to say albergo. So it's an easy language.
Joel was looking up and down the cramped street, evidently his new neighborhood.
Easier than English.
We'll see. How many do you speak?
5 or 6.
They entered and walked through the small foyer. Luigi nodded knowingly at the clerk behind the front desk.
Joel managed a passable buongiorno, but kept walking, hoping to avoid a more involved reply. They climbed 3 flights of stairs and walked to the end of a narrow hallway. Luigi had the key to room 30, a simple but nicely appointed suite with windows on 3 sides and a view of a canal below.
"This is the nicest one," Luigi said. "Nothing fancy, but adequate."
"You should have seen my last room." Joel tossed his bag on the bed and began opening curtains. Luigi opened the door to the very small closet.
"Look here. You have 4 shirts, 4 slacks, 2 jackets, 2 pairs of shoes, all in your size, plus a heavy wool overcoat. It gets quite cold here in Treviso."
Joel stared at his new wardrobe. The clothes were hanging perfectly, all pressed and ready to wear. The colors were subdued, tasteful, and every shirt could be worn with every jacket and pair of slacks. He finally shrugged and said, "Thanks."
"In the drawer over there, you'll find a belt, socks, underwear, everything you need. In the bathroom, you'll find all the necessary toiletries."
"What can I say?"
"And here on the desk are 2 sets of glasses."
Luigi picked up a pair of glasses and held them to the light. The small rectangular lenses were secured by thin black metal, very European frames.
"Armani,"
Luigi said with a trace of pride.
"Reading glasses?"
"Yes and no.
I suggest you wear them every moment you're outside this room. Part of the disguise, Marco. Part of the new you."
"You should have met the old one."
"No, thanks. Appearance is very important to Italians, especially those of us from here in the north. Your attire, your glasses, your haircut, everything must be put together properly or you will get noticed."
Joel was suddenly self-conscious, but then what the hell? He had been wearing prison garb for longer than he cared to remember. Back in the glory days, he routinely dropped $3,000 for a finely tailored suit. Luigi was still lecturing.
"No shorts, no black socks and white sneakers, no polyester slacks, no golf shirts, and please, don't start getting fat."
"How do you say kiss my ass in Italian?"
"We'll get to that later. Habits and customs are important. They're easy to learn and quite enjoyable. For example, never order cappuccino after 10:30 in the morning. But an espresso can be ordered at any hour of the day. Did you know that?"
"I did not."
"Only tourists order cappuccino after lunch or dinner. A disgrace. All that milk on a full stomach."
For a moment, Luigi frowned as if he might just vomit for good measure. Joel raised his right hand and said, "I swear I'll never do it."
"Have a seat," Luigi said, waving at the small desk and its 2 chairs.
They sat down and tried to get comfortable. He continued,
"First, the room. It's in my name, but the staff thinks that a Canadian businessman will be staying here for a couple of weeks."
"A couple of weeks?"
"Yes. Then you'll move to another location."
Luigi said this as ominously as possible, as if squads of assassins were already in Treviso looking for Joel Backman.
"From this moment on, you will be leaving a trail. Keep that in mind. Everything you do, everyone you meet, they're all part of your trail. The secret of survival is to leave behind as few tracks as possible. Speak to very few people, including the clerk at the front desk and the housekeeper. Hotel personnel watch their guests, and they have good memories. 6 months from now, someone might come to this very hotel and start asking questions about you. He might have a photograph. He might offer bribes. And the clerk might suddenly remember you and the fact that you spoke almost no Italian."
"I have a question."
"I have very few answers."
"Why here? Why a country where I cannot speak the language? Why not England or Australia, someplace where I could blend in easier?"
"That decision was made by someone else, Marco, not me."
"That's what I figured."
"Then why did you ask?"
"I don't know."
"Can I apply for a transfer?"
"Another useless question."
"A bad joke, not a bad question.
Can we continue?"
"Yes. For the first few days, I will take you to lunch and dinner. We'll move around, always going to different places. Treviso is a nice city with lots of cafes, and we'll try them all.
You must start thinking of the day when I will not be here. Be careful who you meet. I have another question.
Yes, Marco.
It's about money. I really don't like being broke. Are you guys planning to give me an allowance or something? I wash your car and do other chores.
What is allowance?
Cash. Okay, money in my pocket. Don't worry about money. For now, I take care of the bills. You will not be hungry.
All right. Luigi reached deep in the barn jacket and pulled out a cell phone.
This is for you.
And who exactly am I going to call?
Me, if you need something. My number is on the back.
Joel took the phone and laid it on the desk.
I'm hungry. I've been dreaming of a long lunch with pasta and wine and dessert, and of course espresso, certainly not cappuccino at this hour, then perhaps the required siesta.
I've been in Italy for 4 days now, and I've had nothing but corn chips and sandwiches. What do you say?
Luigi glanced at his watch. I know just the place, but first some more business.
You speak no Italian, right?
Joel rolled his eyes and exhaled mightily in frustration. Then he tried to smile and said,
Nope, I've never had the occasion to learn Italian or French or German or anything else.
I'm an American, okay, Luigi? My country is larger than all of Europe combined. All you need is English over there.
You're Canadian, remember?
Okay, whatever, but we're isolated, just us and the Americans. My job is to keep you safe.
Thank you.
And to help us do that, you need to learn a lot of Italian as quickly as possible.
I understand.
You will have a tutor, a young student by the name of Ermanno. You will study with him in the morning and again in the afternoon. The work will be difficult.
For how long?
As long as it takes. That depends on you.
If you work hard, then in 3 or 4 months, you should be on your own.
How long did it take you to learn English?
My mother is American. We spoke English at home, Italian everywhere else.
That's cheating.
What else do you speak?
Spanish, French, a few more.
Ermanno is an excellent teacher. The classroom is just down the street.
Not here in the hotel?
No, no, Marco. You must think about your trail. What would the bellboy or the housekeeper say if a young man spent 4 hours a day in this room with you?
God forbid.
The housekeeper would listen at the door and hear your lessons. She would whisper to her supervisor. Within a day or two, the entire staff would know that the Canadian businessman is studying intensely, 4 hours a day.
Gotcha.
Now about lunch.
Leaving the hotel, Joel managed to smile at the clerk, a janitor, and the bell captain without uttering a word. They walked one block to the center of Treviso, the Piazza dei Signori, the main square lined with arcades and cafes. It was noon and the foot traffic was heavier as the locals hurried about for lunch. The air was getting colder, though Joel was quite comfortable tucked inside his new wool overcoat. He tried his best to look Italian.
Inside or outside? Luigi asked.
Inside, Joel said, and they ducked into the Café Beltrame, overlooking the piazza. A brick oven near the front was heating the place, and the aroma of the daily feast was steaming from the rear. Luigi and the head waiter both spoke at the same time. Then they laughed, then a table was found by a front window.
We're in luck,
Luigi said as they took off their coats and sat down.
The special today is faraona con polenta.
And what might that be?
Guinea fowl with polenta.
What else? Luigi was studying one of the blackboards hanging from a rough-hewn crossbeam.
Panzerotte di funghi al burro. Fried mushroom pastries. Conchiglie con cavalfiore. Pasta shells with cauliflower. Spiedino di carne misto alla griglia. Grilled shish kebab of mixed meats.
I'll have it all.
Their house wine is pretty good.
I prefer red. Within minutes, the cafe was crowded with locals, all of whom seemed to know each other. A jolly little man with a dirty white apron sped by the table, slowed just long enough to make eye contact with Joel, and wrote down nothing as Luigi spat out a long list of what they wanted to eat. A jug of house wine arrived with a bowl of warm olive oil and a platter of sliced focaccia.
and Joel began eating. Luigi was busy explaining the complexities of lunch and breakfast, the customs and traditions and mistakes made by tourists trying to pass themselves off as authentic Italians. With Luigi, everything would be a learning experience. Though Joel sipped and savored the first glass of wine, the alcohol went straight to his brain. A wonderful warmth and numbness embraced his body. He was free, many years ahead of schedule, and sitting in a rustic little cafe in an Italian town he'd never heard of, drinking a nice local wine and inhaling the smells of a delicious feast. He smiled at Luigi as the explanations continued, but at some point, Joel drifted into another world. Ermanno claimed to be 23 years old, but looked no more than 16. He was tall and painfully thin, and with sandy hair and hazel eyes, he looked more German than Italian. He was also very shy and quite nervous, and Joel did not like the first impression. They met Ermanno at his tiny apartment on the third floor of an ill-kept building, 6 blocks or so from Joel's hotel. There were 3 small rooms, kitchen, bedroom, living area, all sparsely furnished, but then Ermanno was a student, so such surroundings were not unexpected. But the place looked as though he had just moved in and might be moving out at any minute. They sat around a small desk in the center of the living room. There was no television. The room was cold and dimly lit, and Joel couldn't help but feel as if he had been placed in some underground highway where fugitives are kept alive and moved about in secret. The warmth of a 2-hour lunch was fading quickly. His tutor's nervousness didn't help matters. When Ermanno was unable to take control of the meeting, Luigi quickly stepped in and kicked things off. He suggested that they study each morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., break for 2 hours, then resume around 1:30 and study until they were tired. This seemed to suit Ermanno and Joel, who thought about asking the obvious. If my new guy here is a student, how does he have the time to teach me all day long? But he let it pass. He'd pursue it later. Oh, the questions he was accumulating. Ermanno eventually relaxed and described the language course. When he spoke slowly, his accent was not intrusive. But when he rushed things, as he was prone to do, his English might as well have been Italian. Once Luigi interrupted and said, "Ermanno, it's important to speak very slowly, at least in the first few days." "Thank you," Joel said like a true smartass. Ermanno's cheeks actually reddened, and he offered a very timid, "Sorry." He handed over the first batch of study aids, course book number 1, along with a small tape player and 2 cassettes.
"The tapes follow the book," he said very slowly. "Tonight you should study chapter 1 and listen to each tape several times. Tomorrow we'll begin there."
"It will be very intense," Luigi added, applying more pressure as if more was needed. "Where did you learn English?" Joel asked.
"At the university," Ermanno said, "in Bologna."
"So you haven't studied in the United States?"
"Yes, I have,"
he said, shooting a quick, nervous glance at Luigi, as if whatever happened in the States was something he preferred not to talk about. Unlike Luigi, Ermanno was an easy read, obviously not a professional. "Where?" Joel asked, probing, seeing how much he could get.
"Furman," Ermanno said. "A smaller school in South Carolina."
"When were you there?" Luigi came to the rescue, clearing his throat.
"You will have plenty of time for this small talk later. It is important for you to forget English, Marco. From this day forward, you will live in a world of Italian. Everything you touch has an Italian name for it. Every thought must be translated. In 1 week, you'll be ordering in restaurants. In 2 weeks, you'll be dreaming in Italian. It's total, absolute immersion in the language and culture, and there's no turning back."
"Can we start at 8 in the morning? Joel asked. Ermanno glanced and fidgeted, finally said,
"Perhaps 8:30.
"Good. I'll be here at 8:30. They left the apartment and strolled back to the Piazza dei Signori. It was mid-afternoon. Traffic was noticeably quieter, the sidewalks almost deserted.
Luigi stopped in front of the Trattoria del Monte. He nodded at the door, said, I'll meet you here at 8 for dinner, okay?
Yes, okay.
You know where your hotel is?
Yes, the albergo.
And you have a map of the city?
Yes.
Good. You're on your own, Marco. And with that, Luigi ducked into an alley and disappeared. Joel watched him for a second, then continued his walk to the main square. He felt very much alone. 4 days after leaving Rudley, he was finally free and unaccompanied, perhaps unobserved, though he doubted it. He decided immediately that he would move around the city, go about his business as if no one was watching him. And he further decided, as he pretended to examine the items in the window of a small leather shop, that he would not live the rest of his life glancing over his shoulder. They wouldn't find him. He drifted until he found himself at Piazza San Vito, a small square where two churches had been sitting for 700 years. The Santa Lucia and San Vito were both closed, but according to the ancient brass plate, they would reopen from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. What kind of place closes from noon to 4? The bars weren't closed, just empty. He finally mustered the courage to sneak into one. He pulled up a stool, held his breath, and said the word, Bira, when the bartender got close. The bartender shot something back, waited for a response, and for a split second, Joel was tempted to bolt. But he saw the tap, pointed at it as if it was perfectly clear what he wanted, and the bartender reached for an empty mug. The first beer in 6 years. It was cool, heavy, tasty, and he savored every drop. A soap opera rattled from a television somewhere at the end of the bar. He listened to it from time to time, understood not a single word, and worked hard to convince himself that he could master the language. As he was making the decision to leave and drift back to his hotel, he looked through the front window. Stennett walked by. Joel ordered another beer. Chapter 7. The Backman affair had been closely chronicled by Dan Sandberg, a veteran of the Washington Post. In 1998, he had broken the story about certain highly classified papers leaving the Pentagon without authorization. The FBI investigation that soon followed kept him busy for half a year, during which he filed 18 stories, most of them on the front page. He had reliable contacts at the CIA and the FBI. He knew the partners at Backman, Pratt, and Bowling, and had spent time in their offices. He hounded the Justice Department for information. He had been in the courtroom the day Backman hurriedly pled guilty and disappeared. A year later, he had written one of two books about the scandal. His sold a respectable 24,000 copies in hardback, the other about half of that. Along the way, Sandberg built some key relationships. One in particular grew into a valuable, if quite unexpected, source. A month before J.C. Hubbard's death, Carl Pratt, then very much under indictment, as were most of the senior partners of the firm, had contacted Sandberg and arranged a meeting. They eventually met more than a dozen times while the scandal ran its course, and in the ensuing years had become drinking buddies. They sneaked away at least twice a year to exchange gossip. 3 days after the pardon story first broke, Sandberg called Pratt and arranged a meeting at their favorite place, a college bar near Georgetown University. Pratt looked awful, as if he'd been drinking for days. He ordered vodka. Sandberg stuck with beer.
So, where's your boy? Sandberg asked with a grin.
He's not in prison anymore, that's for sure.
Pratt took a near-lethal slug of vodka and smacked his lips.
No word from him?
None. Not me, not anyone at the firm.
Would you be surprised if he called or stopped by?
Yes and no. Nothing surprises me with Backman.
More vodka.
If he never set foot in D.C. again, I wouldn't be surprised. If he showed up tomorrow and announced the opening of a new law firm, I wouldn't be surprised.
The pardon surprised you.
Yes, but that wasn't Backman's deal, was it?
I doubt it.
A co-ed walked by and Sandberg gave her a look. Twice divorced, he was always on the prowl. He sipped his beer and said,
He can't practice law, can he? I thought they yanked his license. That wouldn't stop Backman. He'd call it government relations or consulting or something else. It's lobbying. That's his specialty. And you don't need a license for that. Hell, half the lawyers in this city couldn't find the nearest courthouse, but they can damn sure find Capitol Hill. What about clients? It's not going to happen. Backman ain't coming back to D.C. Unless you've heard something different.
I've heard nothing. He vanished. Nobody at the prison is talking. I can't get a word from the penal folks.
What's your theory? Pratt asked, then drained his glass and seemed poised for more.
I found out today that Teddy Maynard went to the White House late on the 19th. Only someone like Teddy could squeeze it out of Morgan. Backman walked away, probably with an escort, and vanished.
Witness protection?
Something like that. The CIA has hidden people before. They have to. There's nothing official on the books, but they have the resources.
So why hide Backman?
Revenge. Remember Aldrich Ames, the biggest mole in CIA history?
Sure.
Now locked away securely in a federal pen. Don't you know the CIA would love to have a crack at him? They can't do it because it's against the law. They cannot target a U.S. citizen either here or abroad.
Backman wasn't a CIA mole. Hell, he hated Teddy Maynard, and the feeling was very mutual.
Maynard won't kill him. He'll just set things up so someone else will have the pleasure.
Pratt was getting to his feet.
You want another one of those? He asked, pointing at the beer. Later, maybe.
Sandberg picked up his pint for the second time and took a drink. When Pratt returned with a double vodka, he sat down and said,
So, you think Backman's days are numbered?
You ask my theory. Let me hear yours.
A reasonable pull on the vodka, then. Same result, but from a slightly different angle.
Pratt stuck his finger in the drink, stirred it, then licked his finger, thinking for a few seconds.
Off the record, okay?
Of course. They had talked so much over the years that everything was off the record.
There was an 8-day period between Hubbard's death and Backman's plea. It was a very scary time. Both Kim Bowling and I were under FBI protection around the clock, around the block, everywhere. Quite odd, really. The FBI was doing its best to send us to prison forever, and at the same time felt compelled to protect us.
A sip as he glanced around to see if any of the college students were eavesdropping. They were not.
There were some threats, some serious movements by the same people who killed J.C. Hubbard. The FBI debriefed us later, months after Backman was gone and things settled down. We felt a bit safer, but Bowling and I paid armed security for 2 years afterward. I still glance in the rearview mirror. Poor Kim has lost his mind.
Who made the threats?
The same people who'd love to find Joel Backman.
Who?
Backman and Hubbard had made a deal to sell their little product to the Saudis for a trainload of money. Very pricey, but far less than the cost of building a brand new satellite system. The deal fell through. Hubbard gets himself killed. Backman hurries off to jail, and the Saudis are not happy at all. Neither are the Israelis, because they wanted to make a deal too. Plus, they were furious that Hubbard and Backman would deal with the Saudis.
He paused and took a drink, as if he needed the fortitude to finish the story.
Then you have the folks who built the system in the first place.
The Russians?
Probably not. J.C. Hubbard loved Asian girls. He was last seen leaving a bar with a gorgeous young leggy thing, long black hair, round face, from somewhere on the other side of the world. Red China uses thousands of people here to gather information. All their U.S. students, businessmen, diplomats, this place is crawling with Chinese who are snooping around. Plus, their intelligence service has some very effective agents. For a matter like this, they wouldn't hesitate to go after Hubbard and Backman.
You're sure it's Red China?
No one's sure, okay? Maybe Backman knows, but he never told anyone. Keep in mind, the CIA didn't even know about the system. They got caught with their pants down, and old Teddy's still trying to catch up.
Fun and games for Teddy, huh?
Absolutely. He fed Morgan a line about national security. Morgan, no surprise, falls for it. Backman walks. Teddy sneaks him out of the country, then watches to see who shows up with a gun. It's a no-lose game for Teddy.
It's brilliant.
It's beyond brilliant, Dan. Think about it. When Joel Backman meets his maker,
No one will ever know about it. No one knows where he is now. No one will know who he is when his body is found.
If it's found.
Exactly.
And Backman knows this.
Pratt drained the second drink and wiped his mouth with a sleeve. He was frowning.
Backman's not stupid by any measure. But a lot of what we know came to light after he went away. He survived 6 years in prison. He probably figures he can survive anything.